Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. As we were coming on air this time yesterday, a picture of utter mayhem was unfurling on the streets of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Today, the human cost of that mayhem is being counted. More than 20 people were killed during the protests against the government's planned tax rises. More than 150 are currently being treated for injuries, many of whom were shot. The police used live ammunition. We had our correspondent attesting to that live on air yesterday. There is some dispute, as we'll hear, as to at what point exactly the police did open fire, whether it was before or after the Parliament complex had been breached. We'll have our first interview with someone from the government in a moment. But first, one of those demonstrating against the proposed tax rises, which so many Kenyans say they simply can't afford on top of their already squeezed incomes. Among the protesters in Nairobi yesterday was the British-Kenyan activist Auna Obama. She's the half-sister of the former US President Barack Obama and runs a foundation in Kenya called Sauti Kuu for disadvantaged young people. She's been telling my NewsHour colleague Julian Marshall what she saw on the streets.
The young people were being tear gassed. They were shooting them with rubber bullets and later on with live bullets. So nobody was expecting to be shot at. And we came out there in order to protest peacefully and to raise awareness for the plight of young people. And suddenly we had all these trucks and armed policemen throwing tear gas and throwing, live ammunition. The young people were peaceful. And in a way, I feel sorry for the police because they were just doing what they were told, I guess. They were following orders, but really there must be a human factor to following orders and knowing what the right thing is to do. So it's a shame that it all escalated and resulted in innocent lives being lost, innocent lives of our children. All they wanted to do was to walk to Parliament, present their case and be heard. As simple as that, and this is their constitutional right. That is all. And it's so unfortunate that we did not listen to this. And instead, we shot at them.
How are you feeling tonight yourself? I mean, you were tear gassed.
I have my chest is a bit congested. My eyes hurt. I have a headache. But that's nothing compared to what the young people have experienced. I was a lot safer than many. Many of them were standing in front of those canisters of tear gas and were being sprayed with this pink liquid. I don't even know what it is. So what I experienced was nothing in comparison. So in other words, when you ask me how I feel, I can tell you I'm fine. I really am fine. I worry about the young people. I am fine.
Auna Obama speaking to NewsHour last night, Kenyan time. The protests, as I mentioned, are about the government's plans to raise more tax in an effort, they say, to bear down on the crushing levels of debt the country holds. We'll look more at that issue in a moment. First, that violence at the demonstrations. Brian Higgins Mbugua is director of elections for the governing UDA party. What's his response to that charge that the police used lethal force far too readily?
I think that is not accurate. We've had two other demonstrations before that were peaceful. They ended well. But yesterday one, there were some elements that infiltrated an otherwise peaceful protest, because the protest started as early as 8, and we saw from 2, 3 p.m. that's when the real violence began. And I think the police acted with utmost restraint up to that point.
Well, we've heard precisely the opposite from the Kenyan president for the International Society of Human Rights, was speaking on the BBC earlier today. She said that the Kenyan police were using live ammunition before the parliament complex was breached by some people. So she said they opened fire, killing people, even before there was any threat to parliament.
Everything was captured right on tape. Those people who were protesting were live on their social media handles. The shootings that happened, the killings that happened were at parliament building. This thing, you cannot just say it was happening in, they were going live in all the platforms. So in this era and age, it goes beyond saying people should provide proof of whatever they're saying.
Let's talk about the substantive issue, the reason people have been protesting. And I mean, they obviously weren't just protesting yesterday. They've been unhappy for quite some time. The basic charges, look, William Ruto got into power by campaigning that he was going to raise living standards for the poor. And what people are seeing instead from the president and his government is the most punishing form of austerity, with these taxes that are being imposed on people. What's your answer to that?
It's true, Kenyans are facing a hard time right now, but we are kind of in a fix, especially on the debt obligation. Last financial year, we were using 1.8 trillion out of a budget of 3.6 trillion to pay our debts. So the debt is the one that is squeezing our fiscal space. And what the president wants to achieve is simple. He wants by 2028, we have a balanced budget. Some things are painful, but hard decisions have to be made.
Yeah.
So we have to go back to the budget.
Okay. But in terms of...
What do we slash?
Okay, so you're talking about slashing public expenditure. Many people would see that as austerity. In terms of the raising taxes, there are these very controversial taxes on ride hailing and food delivery services that employ lots and lots of young people in a country where youth unemployment is absolutely terrible. Raising tax on internet and telephone usage, again, hugely important to many people. Any possibility that those tax rises could be scrapped?
What most people should understand, especially people from a developed country, is that our economy is largely informal and our economy is going digital. So you find digital solutions have eaten into the legacy industry, which were formal and paying taxes. If we don't find a way of taxing emerging trend, we'll be putting the burden to the white collar people who are very few.
Just one final question, if I may. Listening to what a lot of Kenyan people seem to be talking about, one of the things that is stoking their anger is just that they think that, you know, the governing party, they like their expensive clothes, they like their expensive watches, they flash their wealth around, and people find that it's just, they're sticking it in their faces. Do you think that maybe just in terms of the way in which people in government present themselves, they've got a bit of an image problem?
I agree on that. Those people in government who are doing that, I hope His Excellency the President will crack the whip, take charge of that. But also I'll urge our Kenyan people to understand the situation that we are in, because where we are headed, if we do not manage our debt crisis, if we do not manage our expenditure, we have to have a sit down. We understand the right to protest. It becomes a give and take. You can't have your cake and eat it. If you want to be listened to, you also have to listen to others. And that's when we will make progress.
Brian Higgins-Mbugua, Director of Elections for the governing UDA. Richard Kagoi is host of the BBC's Focus on Africa podcast and joins us live from Nairobi. Richard, as I speak to you, I see on the Reuters news agency a couple of news lines. I mean, firstly, that the Kenyan president, William Ruto, is due to address the nation about now. I don't know if he's started. But the other significant line that they've got is that he's sent the bill on these tax rises back to Parliament for further amendments. What can you tell us about both those things?
Yeah, so we're expecting the president to be addressing the nation anytime now. So we don't know basically what's the content of the address. I know there's been lots of anxiety, but I thought maybe in terms of public communication, it would be really critical for the president to just keep the nation abreast in terms of how things are developing this far. So everybody is, you know, waiting with a bated breath what will be coming out of State House anytime now. In terms of the status of the bill, because once it's been approved, once it's sailed through Parliament, through the three stages of debate, scrutiny and reading, then the president is supposed to either assent to it or reject it. So the president has declined, you know, to approve the bill and sent it back to Parliament for consideration in terms of, you know, a raft of issues that needs to be amended. I don't have in terms of the content of what is being proposed in terms of amendments. Maybe that's what we'll be hearing from the president's address this afternoon.
But it just suggests a measure of flexibility, doesn't it? I mean, it suggests that the government has heard that there is real anger spread far and wide in Kenya about these proposed tax rises.
Absolutely. Following the president's address on Tuesday night, the general consensus was that people were really quite conflicted about the tone, the speech that he presented to the nation. Well, he came through as more assertive and not seeming to be responsive to the issues that were, you know, top on the minds of many Kenyans, as people are quite shell-shocked with how the protest had developed. Yeah, so basically looks like the president might be, you know, saying, you know what, I think we need to reason out these issues. We need to come to the table, discuss, and we find, say, maybe like a common ground that would work out for both, even as Brian has just intimated there, that the executive is finding itself in a very tricky situation in terms of balancing some of the issues, very pressing in terms of the loan obligations. And then, of course, there's the reality in terms of expenditure. So we're expecting to hear more in terms of what the government thinks and what's going to be really like the way forward out of all this.
And what is your assessment of just how far the government's hands are tied by those debt obligations? I mean, there seems to be a lot of anger in Kenya directed towards the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Yes, and unknown to many is that actually this anger just didn't start recently. Started off a couple of years into President, former President Uhuru Kenyatta's term in office, because, you know, successive governments have taken lots of credit to finance some of these ambitious infrastructure projects and, you know, sort of like these investments. And now the loans have now come due in terms of repayment. And a lot of people have been feeling, and I remember even at one point where, you know, young protesters really, you know, went online and pleaded with the IMF not to disburse loans that have been requested by the Kenyan government then when former President Uhuru Kenyatta was in office. And now when, you know, President Ruto has found himself in office, he's got all these loans that are falling due, he needs to pay. So Kenyans are really quite angry in terms of just management of the issues. They're saying, Richard, you don't need to raise the taxes, you just need to cut the fat. Yeah.
Richard Kagoi in Nairobi, thank you very much. And coming up here on NewsHour, we'll hear from the singer Shania Twain ahead of her show at the Glastonbury Festival in Britain on Sunday.
I'd love to be able to sing with everyone and be a part of the journey of the crowd. So I'm going to do everything familiar. I want to do the hits. I want to do what they know.
The music and the words of Shania Twain are getting very excited about a legend set on Sunday at Glasto. More from her in 30 minutes. One headline from the BBC newsroom to tell you about, which we'll be looking at also in about 30 minutes. A former Islamist rebel from Mali has been found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. The WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, has arrived back in Australia. The crowd of well-wishers that had gathered after dark at Canberra Airport after Assange had formally been freed by a US judge presiding in a courtroom on a remote Pacific Ocean island. Assange had, as part of a plea bargain, concluded with the American authorities, pleaded guilty on one charge relating to his publication of a huge cache of classified documents back in 2010. The ensuing legal battle had lasted 14 years, including several years in a high-security jail in London, as he fought attempts to extradite him to stand trial in the US. At a press conference in the last few hours, his lawyer, Jennifer Robinson, who was on the flight with Assange, thanked the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese.
I became very emotional the moment we landed, and the Prime Minister was the first person to get on the phone to speak to Julian. Julian thanked him and the team and told the Prime Minister that he had saved his life. And I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Katie Watson is up very late at night for us in Canberra. She was at that press conference and saw Assange get off the plane. We haven't heard from Assange himself, have we, Katie?
No, we've not. Stella Assange was also at the press conference. She said that he wouldn't be attending. Her husband needed time to recuperate and let our family be a family before he would be speaking publicly. But, you know, he gave a wave, which was probably the biggest sign of emotion that he's had. Obviously been very tight-lipped and straight-faced going into the when he was on the Pacific island of Saipan, coming here to Australia. He let his emotions show, certainly, with a big hug and a kiss for his wife and for his father.
And we heard that rather emotional statement from his lawyer. What else did you pick out from the news conference that there was?
Well, I mean, yeah, highlighting the fact that Albanese, that Assange told Albanese that he saved his life and was not an exaggeration. Albanese also said that he believes in standing up for Australian citizens. I think overall it's that support that the Australian government gave him. It's the continuing kind of diplomacy and conversations and lobbying of the US that seemed to be going on behind closed doors, especially in the last year or so with Albanese, you know, going to the White House, bringing the topic up, having cross-party politicians and delegations coming to Washington to try and speak to people, to try and you know, put forward their cause. All of this has been recognised, and I think certainly in Australia, the efforts that the government went to try and bring Julian Assange back home.
There is still a bit of anger, though, among his supporters. Am I right in saying that they sort of feel that this whole charge and this whole protracted legal process has, in their eyes, criminalised journalism?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that his US lawyer also said. The legal team said several times today that the prosecution, you know, should never have been brought. And that's something that I think, you know, he will also answer to, you know, this guilty plea that, you know, was not that many of his supporters say that was not justified. That this is not, you know, it wasn't fair, and still maintain that that's something that should never have happened in the first place. I think, you know, he's also a difficult character who's obviously divided, but certainly here the support has been that this should never have happened and he should be back here now.
Katie Watson in Canberra, up late for us. Thanks very much. On Sunday, France sees the first round of snap elections called by President Macron after his trouncing by the far right in the European elections. All the polls suggest that the strong frontrunner is the hard right National Rally. There's a chance there may be a hung parliament, in other words, no single grouping having a majority, but it's also quite possible there could be an outright victory for National Rally, something unprecedented in post-war France. It's an election with a huge amount riding on it. Hugh Schofield reports from the Seine-et-Marne department, south of Paris.
What could be finer than music on a hot summer's day in a historic town square in provincial France? This is Fontainebleau, home once to the Emperor Napoleon. Today, it's natural Macron territory. Like the man, it's prosperous, international, and since 2 weeks ago, deeply worried.
I am Juliette Villegrain.
I've come to see the woman who, till the Assembly was so unexpectedly dissolved, was the local MP. Today, she's campaigning again for the Macronite centre, and with a simple message: keep out the extremes.
The extremes are very dangerous. The right wing, the RN, once they are in the power, they are there to stay. They will change things so that we won't be able to get them out. And of course, right now they tell you what you want to hear. In reality, those propositions are not possible.
So what are the risks? I believe that...
For all their efforts, though, the Macronite centre in France is not holding. Things are falling apart. The far right could win in 2 weeks, or there'll be political paralysis. And for the veteran commentator Nicolas Bavaret, either possibility presents risks: a debt crisis, social unrest, political collapse.
It's really a situation where you may have a brutal breakup of the institutions.
Si on va au bout de votre raisonnement, le pays explose ou c'est la guerre civile?
And there was another word on President Macron's lips this week: guerre civile, civil war.
Civil war is a word that Macron mentioned.
Yes, and I think that it's very dangerous, because the fact for him to use this word and to try to save his power, in fact, on fear, this is very dangerous, because you know that in a democracy, when you play on fears, then you have hate and then violence. So this dynamic is one of the most dangerous for a democratic country.
So what you're saying is that when President Macron talks about civil war, even as a theoretical possibility, he makes it more possible?
Yes, of course.
Alarmist? It certainly feels it out here in the southern part of the Fontainebleau constituency, where the peace of the deep French countryside seems to mock the scary talk of the towns. But this is prime National Rally turf.
I'm not hurt when I see a Muslim who prays...
The RN candidate is Ivanka Dimitrova, Bulgarian by birth, so an immigrant herself, but a woman who feels a profound cultural attachment to France and a fear that its distinctiveness is under threat from uncontrolled immigration. People who come here, she says, cannot expect to rule the roost.
But the dominating one must stay dominating.
Are you a dangerous party?
No, I don't think so. No, no, no. Certainly not.
Are you an extremist party?
No, I don't see anything extreme. When you have your family and someone is doing harm to the members of your family, you want to protect them. Are you extremist with this? No. Our family is France. We want to protect our family. That's all.
There's no inevitability about unrest and insurrection in France, but there is, given its history, perhaps a susceptibility. With the way things are going, a far right and a far left that hate each other, both gaining in power, one might almost say a likelihood.
And that was Hugh Schofield reporting from just south of Paris. Those parliamentary elections, the first round of them, on Sunday. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Scientists in Japan have found a new way to attach modified human skin to complex humanoid robot surfaces. NewsHour's Julian Marshall spoke to Chris Dorsey, an associate professor at the Institute for Experiential Robotics at Northeastern University in Boston in the US. What exactly did they do?
You might want to put skin on a robot face to make it look realistic. The skin is very soft and stretchable, but the underlying robot face is very hard material. It makes it really hard to get a three-dimensional shape. So what they've done is make these anchors between the skin and the robot that mimic human skin. So it is very similar to the skin ligaments that go between the skin of our face and the muscles underneath. Their approach might make the skin more durable and long-lasting over time.
Is it live skin?
It is live skin cells, yes, mixed in with collagen.
And how long does it stay alive?
So that's not something they addressed directly in the paper, but what they did demonstrate was culturing the collagen and the skin cells over a week.
Is keeping the skin alive the main challenge at the moment?
I think that's a rather large challenge. So one of the things that the scientists in this work have not done is investigate blood vessels and lymphatic vessels that would help transport nutrients and oxygen to the skin cells and also transport them away.
Are there any particular advantages to using modified human skin rather than synthetic skin for humanoid robots?
Yes, there are a couple of advantages. One is that skin has self-healing properties. If we have a robot that's out in the world and it scrapes or cuts itself, it could heal rather than needing to apply new material. Another is that skin has touch sensors and temperature sensors already embedded within it, and may also be able to do things like help the robot sweat to cool off, which means that the robot itself could do more work.
Is this something of a competition to see whether synthetic or real skin will win out, or are there different uses for each?
It's a bit of a competition between different research groups, for sure, but also I see synthetic skin without any biological components, as well as engineered skin with skin cells in it, as having different purposes. Maybe we would want to use a self-healing material for a robot that will go out and do something for a few days, but we might want a robot that looks really realistic or that will last for a really long time to have the self-regeneration and self-healing properties of human skin.
Is this a procedure that's only applicable to humanoid robots, or could it have any use for humans as well?
One of the things in the paper that I thought was really interesting is they proposed to use the skin that they had engineered to understand wrinkle formation in humans. Could also have lots of potential uses for things like prosthetic devices, which would interface with your own skin.
Chris Dorsey from the Institute for Experiential Robotics at Northeastern University in Boston, talking to Julian Marshall. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Head shaved, arms folded, the American journalist Evan Gershkovich appeared today in what's known as the aquarium, the metal and glass cage used in courtrooms in Russia to house, to display defendants. Today has been the start of his trial on espionage charges, 15 months after he was first detained by the authorities. The reporter was on assignment for the Wall Street Journal in Yekaterinburg, 1,000 miles from the capital, and that's where his trial is also taking place. The media were allowed in to see him, but then ushered out before proceedings began on the grounds of national security. Prosecutors claimed that Gershkovich was collecting classified information about a Russian tank manufacturer and he was doing so at the behest of the CIA. We've seen no evidence of this, no one has, and Evan Gershkovich himself and the US government vehemently deny the charges, as do his employers. Gráinne McCarthy is International Chief Digital Editor of the Wall Street Journal and is leading the campaign for Evan's release and is here in the NewsHour studio. Gráinne, thank you for your time. What did you make of Evan's appearance today?
It was pretty jarring just to see him in a new location. We've kind of gotten slightly used. You never really get used to it, but seeing we've seen Evan in court a number of occasions over the past 15 months, always in that glass cage. It's always really difficult. It's emotionally a gut punch to see him in, to see him there. But at the same time, it's good to see him looking well. He flashed a smile. He waved at one point. To see him, and actually that aquarium, what really struck me was there was a padlock on it. Just to kind of hammer the message home.
Yeah. He's a reporter. I mean, we're used to hearing his voice, and he is literally silenced. Isn't he?
Yeah, and I'd just like to say that this is clearly a sham trial based on baseless accusations by the Russian government. Evan is a brilliant reporter. He was based here in our London newsroom. He was hired as a reporter in Moscow. But after the war in Ukraine began, Evan would come back and forth to London. So we know him really well in London. He's a brilliant reporter. He has covered many big stories in Russia. He's steeped in Russian culture, Russian language, grew up in a family. His parents were Soviet emigres to the United States. He's born and raised in the US. But he is very interested in Russia. He actually covered the Brittany Griner case, where Brittany Griner was exchanged for Russian arms dealer Viktor Boot.
The US
so
basketball
he knows story, the playbook.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we've missed out. Not only has Evan missed out on 15 months of his life that have been stolen from him, but we've missed out on that reporting and his eye on Russia.
I don't know how much you can say, I don't know how much you know, but I mean, Vladimir Putin himself, he name-checked Evan Gershkovich in that interview with Tucker Carlson earlier this year, where he said, you know, he was open to a deal. I mean, clearly you hope that he will be out as soon as possible. I mean, do you think that behind closed doors talks are going on?
I mean, Vladimir Putin has mentioned Evan a few times, actually, and we had a Russian official, like, even today, mentioning a willingness to continue to talk and, you know, reach some sort of a negotiation. We obviously never wanted to get to this point, and to see Evan continue to be in this awful situation, a 32-year-old reporter.
Who's already spent 15 months behind bars.
Who's already lost 15 months of his life. But we can only hope that the fact that this sham trial is now underway can raise the pressure even further to secure his release. Those conversations are happening at a government-to-government level. I'm not privy to them. But, you know, all we want is for Evan to be released. It cannot happen soon enough.
Do you think he is aware of the level of support there is internationally for him?
I think he is. I mean, obviously he doesn't have access to a phone or to a, you know, internet or anything like that. But we have been able to communicate with Evan over these past 15 months. He has a remarkable group of friends, and Evan himself is a remarkable friend to them, a connector of individuals. He's really that kind of person. And they rallied immediately to set up a letter writing sort of method that to send letters to Evan and that he can write back as well. He's been actually playing a long distance game of chess with his dad. There's nothing better in your day than getting a letter from Evan. So, he clearly doesn't have unfettered access to the outside world, but I think he is aware of the support, and I think that's really important.
Gráinne McCarthy, International Chief Digital Editor of The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for coming into the NewsHour studio. Fentanyl is a familiar dread name when it comes to the scourge of synthetic opioids. Now, there's a newer family of narcotics, nitazenes, which the UN Office on Drugs and Crime has today warned are in some cases even more potent than fentanyl, which has caused tens of thousands of deaths in the US alone. And the UN says there's growing evidence that nitazenes have been responsible for an increase in fatal overdoses in many countries. Matt Perry is a British man who's been addicted to heroin for most of his life. Last August, he took what he thought was heroin, but it had been laced with nitazenes. He ended up in hospital. Says he was so scared by the experience that he's been off drugs ever since. He's working now with a charity to help with his recovery. This is what he told the BBC reporter Navtej Johal.
I had tubes down my throat and I was in a bad way, very bad way.
And what did they tell you had happened to you?
That I had died. That I had died that day. This thing is the most terrifying thing I've ever experienced, ever faced. I'd never wanted to. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. I wouldn't. It's terrifying.
I've been speaking to Ant Lehane, policy lead at the UK-based charity Cranston, which is focused on harm reduction and social justice. Nitazenes are, he says, a growing threat.
So opioids are a family of drugs which are painkillers. One very obvious example of an opioid would be heroin. But synthetic opioids and particularly nitazenes differ in that they're around 50 to 300 times stronger than street heroin. So people are much more likely to overdose and those overdoses are much more likely to be fatal. The emergence of nitazenes has crept in on us. We warned of the dangers of nitazenes in August last year. And I think the first mention that we saw of them was around 12 months prior to that. So the easiest thing to compare it to would be the fentanyl situation in the United States.
And I think lots of people will be familiar with the destruction that's been wrought by fentanyl in particular in North America. Can you give me some sort of comparison? Are nitazenes similar in effects?
It's believed they're of a similar strength, just to give you a sense of quite how bad it could get. The United States has called a public health emergency. 70,000 people died from synthetic opioids, mostly fentanyl, in 2022 alone. And I think that's something like a 23-fold increase over just a few short years, I think over a six-year period.
In terms of, you know, where this stuff is coming from, are there established routes?
Part of the reason why it's believed that fentanyl and nitazenes are starting to become more prevalent is that they're very easy to ship. So because they're so significantly more potent, a kilogram of nitazenes would have significantly more doses than that same weight in heroin. So in short, you only need to smuggle a much, much, much physically smaller package. It seems like a lot of it is being manufactured and ordered in China. So you can go on the dark web and quite easy, I think for around $6,000, you can buy a range of different analogs of nitazenes for, I think it works out about a cent a dose coming from China.
Are people aware that they are taking nitazenes?
I think the vast majority of people wouldn't be aware, at least originally, of what they were taking. They would probably intend to be buying heroin. Many people selling nitazenes might also actually be unaware of what they're selling. Usually, because of the potency of it, it's cut into either potent weak heroin or it could also be nitazene just mixed with mannitol, which is an agent to make it go longer. The vast majority of people would not realise that they're taking nitazenes, and that's part of the danger. The other danger is that there's this inconsistency between batches and doses, because if you're cutting something quite so potent into a small wrap of heroin, it's very easy to have one wrap which is exceedingly strong and could make someone even with a very strong tolerance overdose and die. However, other batches won't be that potent because there'd be such a small amount of nitazenes in there. So it's that kind of lucky dip effect, really, yeah, which is very concerning.
You made the point that nitazenes are cheaper to produce and easier to ship. Is demand also being driven by the fact that the traditional opioids that we know about, heroin, that production has been fairly successfully tamped down, particularly by the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Yes. So I believe the UN report in 2023 stated that global production of Afghanistan was down around 90%, I believe. And Afghanistan supplies the vast, vast, vast majority of the UK's drug market and a lot of the global heroin supply. So the opium poppy cultivation crackdown has definitely had a significant impact. I think there is also a bit of discussion as to whether it's just that. So fentanyl's existed in the United States for a long time because of the cartels, predominantly from Mexico, who've recognized that actually it's cheaper and easier to produce and traffic. So there is also a fear that irrespective of what happens with Taliban's opium poppy cultivation ban, that this might become the new normal for necessity and the greed of certain criminal gangs who have found an easier way to make money.
And tell me about the sort of effects that you and your colleagues have been seeing on the ground in terms of what nitazenes do.
My colleagues on the ground have definitely seen a worsening situation. Most of the people who use our services don't want to die and probably don't want to be using nitazenes. But I do think there's an additional fear among people on the streets that every time they inject or smoke a drug which might contain nitazenes, that they could die, you know, that could be the last thing they do. I do think there is a real palpable fear.
What can we do to try and break the hold that nitazenes are having?
Cranston proposed an 8-point plan last year, and that included a number of different harm reduction measures. So we need to get more people into treatment at an earlier point. Other potential solutions include drug checking. There are services where people can go and test their drugs to see exactly what's in them.
Are any countries getting it right?
I think there's countries that are doing it better than us, but I don't think anyone's getting it right. The best example of a kind of functioning model, I would suggest, would be Portugal, and that sort of around the legality of substances, the decriminalisation of people who use the substances, and the sort of supporting measures in place. The supporting measures in place are what's really key.
And in terms of the US, I mean, obviously there is this comparison between nitazenes and fentanyl.
Yes.
Are there lessons to be drawn from the way in which the US has tried to handle or maybe mishandled the fentanyl epidemic there?
There's a lot of lessons that could be taken from the US. I think the first one is probably around the dangers of prescribing. Obviously, a lot of these people who started using opioids in the US were originally using prescribed opioids. I think aside from that, the US didn't do nearly enough to grip the crisis. I do wonder if the situation has been worsened in the US by the lack of provision and things like, you know, costs in calling ambulances and things like that.
And that was Ant Lehane from the Cranston Charity. Just while we're on air, I'm seeing William Ruto, the Kenyan president, address the country from State House. And he has just confirmed within the last few seconds that he will not sign that very controversial finance bill, the one proposing lots and lots of tax rises that prompted those deadly protests of Tuesday. You're listening to NewsHour. Here with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has today convicted an Islamist militant of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Mali. Judges found Al-Hassan Abdul Aziz guilty of atrocities in the ancient city of Timbuktu, where jihadists swept in to take control back in 2012. Our correspondent Anna Holligan is outside the courtroom in The Hague. Anna, what's the background to this Islamist militant's crimes? Take us back to that ancient city back in 2012.
So when the Islamists overran the fabled city of Timbuktu, they tried to impose their harsh, brutal interpretation of Sharia law, and it was the civilians, of course, who suffered. So Mr. Al-Hassan was accused of being the de facto police chief, the one who was involved in ensuring that the orders handed down by the Islamic court were enforced. And his defence lawyers, he was in court today, he was wearing a traditional Tuareg headscarf and yellow robe, sitting behind his lawyers. His lawyers had argued that he was simply following orders and that he was trying to maintain some level of control in a very chaotic situation. The judges ruled, though, that he had been instrumental in torture, in amputations, in outrages upon personal dignity, and in the holding of these kind of mock trials. But the thing that was so interesting about this trial was that the prosecution had sought for the first time at the International Criminal Court to focus on gender-based persecution. So the previous prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, had talked about women and girls as so often being the hidden victims in conflict. And she sought to change that with this case. But on those charges, although the judges here at the ICC said that women and girls were subjected to wide-ranging sexual violence, they said there wasn't sufficient evidence to find Mr. Al-Hassan responsible. So he was cleared on charges of sexual slavery, forced marriages, and rape. And we heard some really devastating testimony from witnesses throughout this case. So it's the prosecution is hoping that even though he was cleared on the charges, it will still help to raise awareness. The other charges he was cleared on, the attacks on the sacred mausoleums and tombs. You may remember some of those images from back in 2012. They were attacked with hammers and pickaxes. He was cleared on those charges too.
When do we expect sentencing to happen?
Well, there will be another hearing to deal with sentencing, and he also has the opportunity to appeal. His lawyers have to submit an appeal within 30 days if they wish to. The other really fascinating aspect of this case is that the ICC went to great lengths to ensure the victims on the ground in Timbuktu had access to justice. They can also now apply for financial reparations.
And also, I mean, I guess, as ever with these cases, just briefly, Anna, the voice of the victims at the trial was key.
It was indeed. And the testimony from the harrowing testimony from so many of the victims talking about being chained together, taken into public squares and flogged hundreds of times. Part of their efforts were to try to ensure that people lived in fear during this, what was described by the prosecution as a reign of terror in the fabled city of Timbuktu.
Anna Holligan in The Hague, thank you very much. The gates have opened today at one of the world's most storied music festivals, Glastonbury, in the west of England. And this year, on what's called the Legends set, it's going to be the Canadian singer Shania Twain. She's going to be talking, she has been talking about that appearance to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Let's go, girls.
Long before Taylor Swift, there was another female country singer who incorporated a pop sound into their music and became a phenomenon. Shania Twain's late 90s album, Come On Over, is one of the top 10 global bestsellers of all time. And this weekend, she follows the likes of Lionel Richie, Dolly Parton and Kylie Minogue by playing Glastonbury's Sunday Tea Time Legends slot.
I've been told that that is the slot.
You know Lionel Richie, don't you?
I know
you?
Lionel Richie.
Now, he had one of the best days of his life doing it.
So he's the one I should ask. It's surreal to have been invited. I'm a little overwhelmed. I mean, from the minute it was even a possibility, I had to keep it a secret. Then it's just been a flurry of everyone sharing all of their fabulous stories and how exciting it's going to be and bring my wellies, and now I'm thinking about which wellies should I bring. I've got several pairs at home. Should I buy new ones?
Have you got rhinestone on your wellies?
I don't. Should I get some with rhinestones?
Okay, so you're Brad Pitt. That don't impress me much.
People who come to watch the Legends, a lot of them will wear fancy dress off the act. So let's go through some of the iconic Shania looks. That don't impress me much. How would you come dressed as in that video, would you say?
Anything in leopard print. Any color of leopard print. Pink, blue, green. That one's easy.
Man, I feel like a woman. Veil and top hat in the sun, is that going to work?
A top hat would work.
Yeah.
Why not? And why not a top hat that, like, pops up so that it doesn't take up any space when you're not wearing it?
Man, I feel like a woman.
Pick one more. One more Shania outfit you'd like to see there in the crowd.
Denim on denim. That works. That's any man of mine video, denim on denim. Any man of mine,
better walk the line. A lot of people go into Glastonbury. It's the only time all year they put up their tent. What's your best putting up a tent tip?
You know what? I believe in pop-up tents. Don't be a hero. Don't fight, don't argue. And bring lots of extra socks. Give me the chance to say
that I'm sorry. And Glastonbury is on a farm. I believe you can talk to animals. Explain about this.
I love horses. Mm-hmm. I love all animals. But I'm going to go see if there's a horse around I can borrow.
Would you bring a horse onto the stage?
If it's allowed, I'll do it. I'd love to ride a horse to the stage.
We're still together, still going strong. You're still the one I run to.
And finally, what kind of show are you going to deliver in the Legend slot?
I'd love to be able to sing with everyone and be a part of the journey of the crowd. So I'm going to do everything familiar. I want to do the hits. I want to do what they know.
Oh, you're still the one I kiss.
The music of Shania Twain. Looking forward to playing Glastonbury on Sunday. She was talking to Colin Paterson. That's it from this edition of NewsHour from me, Tim Franks, and the team here in London. Thanks for listening.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.